This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's show, hip-hop in the hoods of Burma. Artists can be censored and even jailed.
Because of the government, they're not able to talk about the subjects that they really want to talk about. For the most part, they can only talk about love. They can only talk about a brighter day.
In California, homeless men write plays about their lives. And in Nepal, we learn how to make fried bread, known there as sel roti.
More often than not, the amateur cook, such as myself, produces a collection of burnt little roti blobs. My young friend Basanta, or Roti as I call him, gets no end of amusement out of watching me try this.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Across the country, kids are shaking the cobwebs out of their backpacks and their brains and heading back to school. For many, the menu of what's available is pretty standard. Biology, algebra, history, you know the routine. But some schools are offering programs that help the kids with non-academic problems. Will Everett reports on an innovative writing program in a small town in Texas.
Life isn't easy for the Gonzalez family. The parents and five kids live in a poor neighborhood just outside of Brownsville, Texas. The father, Marcelino, is a musician who sometimes has to pawn one of his guitars to pay the bills. But they get by, and according to his wife, Rachel, everyone gets along. 10 years ago, however, the domestic picture was very different. She recalls how Marcelino would come home late from playing gigs, usually drunk or high, and invariably there would be fights.
It was like, where were you? You were supposed to get here at 2:30. You're off at 2. And it was a constant fight about that, you know, where we would get physical about it.
One night 10 years ago, there was a heated exchange, and Marcelino attacked her with a kitchen stool.
My eye was purple, and, you know, I even have a little scar over here on my skull because he didn't only hit me with the stool, but he hit me with his boots on my head.
Their daughter, Siria, who was 8 at the time, hid in the bedroom during the attack. She has vivid memories of that night.
He had hit her with a stool. She was right there on the floor, and I remember feeling hopeless. And I remember holding her because we didn't know what to do. And I'm completely hopeless. And even more because we were little. What could we do? All we could do was just stand there crying, holding each other.
6-year-old Selena was also hiding in the bedroom that night. She says she's blocked out much of what happened.
The only image that I remember was just looking up at my mom and just a bunch of blood just coming down from her forehead all on her face. That's the only image that I have from that night.
2 years later, Marcelina was released from prison for the assault, but the family never talked about the incident. Then in junior high school, one of Selena's teachers asked her to write on the subject of violence for a school project. Selena's class was taking part in Do the Right Thing, a program that raises awareness about the causes and consequences of violence. For the first time, she was able to put words to her old fears.
When I was young, about the age of 6, unfortunately, I was a witness to a violent scene. It was very late, and my dad wasn't home yet, and that made me feel worried that he had gotten hurt or something. My mom said, "Sire Selena."
Do the Right Thing gets kids to write about the violence they witness in their homes, schools, and neighborhoods. The program was founded by Dan Collister, an attorney living in California. While it's mostly aimed at reducing youth violence, Collister says the program often touches the lives of adults.
He realizes that he really hurt his family, but they all love each other. And they know that by having this healing experience, that's a great role model. That's a great experience for them to have that they may replicate.
That's what happened in the Gonzalez family.
By her writing this essay, you know, it has helped my family in this way.
Rachel Gonzalez.
We are changing. We have more communication. We have more tolerance towards each other. And we've changed.
I had always considered my dad to be one of my heroes. And while he was in jail, I realized that there was no way that he could be it any longer.
This is Selena reading from her essay.
Each and every time I was allowed to see my dad, I broke into tears because something in my chest hurt so bad. I realized it was my heart.
The essay was a wake-up call to Marcelino and Rachel, who hadn't realized the extent to which their fights had affected their children.
There are many other ways you could solve your problems instead of...
They still have their occasional arguments, but they've found healthy ways of managing their anger. Marcelino has learned to walk away from heated arguments.
Well, now I'll leave the house. I'd rather walk outside than pay attention to her. It shames me to fight in front of the girls, and I don't want things to get out of hand.
He's also spending more time with his kids. When I met them, he and Selena were playing the Selena Cha-Cha-Cha, a song that Marcelino had performed at a party for Selena last year. They're now turning the song into a duet with Selena on flute.
A lot of people might say, how can their life be changed by a story, a paper that was written? It can change their lives because it's changed mine. It has. I mean, this program is great.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett in Brownsville, Texas.
And here's another back-to-school story. Charter schools have been around for about a decade now. These are schools that receive public money, but they're run more like private schools. Here's President Obama speaking about them in his State of the Union address in February.
We'll invest in innovative programs that are already helping schools meet high standards and close achievement gaps. And we will expand our commitment to charter schools.
Those words must have pleased Dennis and Eileen Bakke. Dennis Bakke was a successful businessman, and his wife Eileen is an educator. They head up a large charter school organization called Imagine Schools. Right now, they run more than 70 charter schools in 13 states. The majority of the students are minorities from low-income families. Eileen Bakke says there's a desperate need for alternative forms of education in the inner city.
Our public school system serves a lot of people very well, but in our biggest urban districts, families are not being well served always, and they don't have the option of moving to the suburbs or going to a private or parochial school. They're stuck. They're assigned to a school, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. And it's not a question of money. It's not a problem that money can solve alone, as we've learned, because you look at some of the highest spending districts in the country, Detroit, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., Chicago, the amount of money spent is not necessarily commensurate with quality education. And so we're really trying to kind of go back to the grassroots and say, school by school, can we bring hope into these communities? Can we make the public school once again a center of hope for the next generation?
Tell me what I would see or hear differently than in your neighborhood public school.
Parents are very, very involved in our schools. In fact, we have a parent covenant. Most of our schools have an agreement for a certain number of volunteer hours, being at a certain number of PTAs, coming to parent-teacher conferences, so that it's a partnership between the school and... Another thing we do is we have mostly K through 8, mostly kindergarten through 8 schools. So leadership development at the middle school is very important. Our middle school students almost always... buddy with and mentor a younger student in the school. So when you create an environment where kids feel valued, where families feel valued, and there's dignity and there's a belief that they can achieve, you know, anything they want to achieve, it really changes the environment of a school. We have parents, I had a grandfather come to me as I was visiting a school, and he said, I took off work and I came an hour from my construction job because I want to tell you that you've changed my granddaughter's life. She cannot wait to get to school in the morning. She's 8 years old, and she had become so embittered because in her former school she was labeled a failure. She had given up. Now she comes and runs to me to read, and she can't wait to, you know, be at school. She doesn't even want to miss school if she's sick. I mean, to me, that is the success. And that's an intangible. It's not a curriculum. It's not a program. But it's trying to create an environment where, you know, kids can become all God made them to be.
What qualifies you to pull off this huge charter school movement?
Well, I think a lot of it is because of Dennis's philosophy of attracting good quality people to work with us and then cutting them loose.
Dennis?
A good leader tries to figure out a way to create an environment where other people can soar. And that really usually means that the leader, and we as leaders, I limit myself to one significant decision a year. I did that with my old company, and I used that same philosophy. We then go right to the regional directors, the superintendents in effect, and then right to the principal and ask them to do exactly the same thing. Why? So that every teacher has the opportunity to really control and make this work. By the way, I wrote a book called Joy at Work. That's the key to joy at work, because when they get a chance, when a person gets a chance to use their own brain power and their talents to make a decision and then hold themselves responsible for that, pure joy.
So you're really using the model you learned as a successful businessman in the education world.
Yes. Organizational leadership is the same in government, in business, in schools, wherever it is.
There's quite a lot of controversy out there about charter schools, and some would say you're stealing students from the public school and you're not really accountable because it's like a private school. How are you held accountable for the performance of your students?
We are authorized by a state institution to have a charter school, and they are essentially our accountability structure. But all of that matters very little. The accountability comes from what Eileen mentioned before. We're helping parents educate students. They are the ones that hold us accountable. They will leave if we're not doing a good job.
So that leads me to ask you, how are you doing?
Our schools are very full, mostly with waiting lists, especially when we go into communities where there has not been school choice, which tells you that there is a pent-up demand for some alternatives in public education. We have 74 schools, and 75% of our students nationwide are minority, 55% low income. So we're going into underserved communities, and many of our students come in very far behind grade level, and these are elementary school students. We spend a lot of time looking at where students start in the fall and where they end in the spring, not sort of what grade level they're at, but how much have we taught them, how much have they learned in a year. And our kids are averaging, our students are averaging a year and a half growth for every year this past year that they're part of an imagined school. So they're coming in behind and making great strides academically.
How important is this, do you think?
It's very important to our country. If you look, Peggy, at the dropout rates, the graduation rates in our urban areas, it's shocking and it's frightening. And all the statistics show that incarceration, for example, you know, is direct in a direct corollary to dropout rates. We can't have in our nation such a disparity of quality and inequality of education.
All right, Dennis and Eileen Bakke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you very much, Peggy.
Dennis and Eileen Bakke are co-founders of Imagine Charter Schools. Coming up, hip-hop takes on the junta, a story from Burma, just ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. The military junta in Burma is one of the most repressive governments in the world. The government controls most of the media and tolerates no dissent from any quarter. But a group of Burmese rappers, you heard it, rappers, are taking on the regime with their edgy lyrics. Andrea Smartin reports.
This song is from 22-year-old Burmese hip-hop artist Killa Cash, or K-Cash. He says it's about kids on the street spending their parents' money and gambling. K-Cash now lives in Los Angeles, but he grew up in Yangon, where poverty was rampant. When he was a teenager, K-Cash found American hip-hop on the internet. In the music of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur, he found something he could relate to.
They all came from the hood, from the street, and then they struggle a lot. It's all about money, you know, try to get money, that they sing about life.
Life in the hoods of Myanmar may not be the same as life in the ghettos of New York or L.A., but some say there are a lot of parallels.
You know, you've got the police watching you. You've got a very hardcore heroin and methamphetamine scene in Burma, both of which are manufactured there. It's where the Golden Triangle is, after all.
Edith Moranti is the author of Down the Rat Hole, Adventures Underground on Burma's Frontiers. She says the frustrated, underemployed youth of Myanmar are constantly reminded that they're living under a military regime.
You're looking at guns all the time. The kids who do hip-hop don't necessarily have any guns themselves. They probably don't, unlike in the American hip-hop scene. But it's a reality to them. It's not just, you know, if you're listening to it in Singapore, it might have a kind of a vicarious thrill for you. But if you're in Burma, this is the real thing.
American hip-hop artists are a rare sight in Myanmar, but New York-based rapper Chris Real traveled there in 2007. He was part of a State Department program called Rhythm Road that aims to bring American culture to audiences around the world. Real was hosted by the U.S. Embassy in Yangon, and he got to meet some of the top rappers while there. He said the music he heard only scratched the surface of what these young people had to say.
Because of the government, they're not able to talk about the subjects that they really want to talk about. For the most part, they can only talk about love. They can only talk about a brighter day. They can't get into specifics.
Music is censored in Myanmar, and artists have been imprisoned when they become openly political. This song was banned by the government. It's from Burmese artist Ta So and his younger brother Bon Bon. It's a plea for more electricity and water, things that are available to most Burmese for only a few hours a day. There's a play on words here. The word me means electricity, but it also means honey or darling. The meaning of the lyrics is veiled in the guise of a love song. Another song from Kay Cash and well-known Burmese hip-hop artist Jay Me manages to criticize the government without calling it by name. On the surface, this song is about people who think they're better than everyone. They try to rule the world with money, the rap goes. Chris Real says what these artists are trying to do goes back to the foundation of hip-hop.
It's all about being a voice for the voiceless. You know the government situation out there, you know the climate out there. And people want to speak. You know, these guys came to the plate and they're trying to let the world know what they're going through out there.
Many Burmese hip-hop artists have been leaving Myanmar and producing music from afar. Ta So is currently in Virginia, but he says he's going back home in a matter of months to work on getting his album out. As for Kay Cash, he says he plans to stay in L.A., but he'll try to release his music through underground channels, posting songs on the internet and shipping free CDs to the tea shops of Myanmar. For the World Vision Report, I'm Andrea Smartin.
The news out of Afghanistan is mostly about the election, the Taliban, or the war. Ben Arnoldi has reported on all of those subjects. He's a journalist for the Christian Science Monitor. On one of his recent trips, Ben traveled to Bamiyan. You might remember the area. It's where ancient stone Buddhas were destroyed by the Taliban 8 years ago. And it's where Afghanistan's first national park was created just this summer. The locals are hoping the park will be a tourist attraction and a way out of poverty. I asked Ben about the park and the prospects for tourism there.
I thought it was the most beautiful place I'd ever been. It was a combination of maybe half a dozen Western United States national parks all rolled into one. I mean, it looked like Monument Valley when you looked up and saw the orange and red mesas. It looked a little bit like Crater Lake in Oregon because there are these half a dozen or so deep blue lakes. It's just a gorgeous color. And then in the distance, you'd see these, they're called the Baba Mountains, 15,000-foot mountains, and it looks like the Rockies. It's very untouched and extremely, extremely beautiful.
I can't imagine there's much of a tourist industry right now in that area. Who goes to this park?
Right now, local Afghans who live in the city of Bamiyan, not too far away, about an hour away, they visit, as do Westerners who are working in Kabul for various non-governmental organizations or diplomats. They'll sometimes take an excursion over here to see the place, as do a few foreign tourists. There is a small fledgling industry for international tourism. Right now, it's sort of in the hundreds or less. But this is one of the premier destinations that these people can go and see.
Well, and I guess the obvious question is it safe to get there and hang out there?
Well, right now you'd have to fly into Kabul, and Kabul has some insecurities in that you probably don't want to be walking around alone. There's been some kidnappings there, so there's a little bit of danger involved in that. And then there's about an eight-hour drive.
Oh my goodness!
On a dusty dirt road, and it's just bone rattling. You get knocked all about. They're starting to work on leveling it, widening it, and paving, and they should be done with that in about a year and a half or so. That will cut down the drive time to about 2 hours. And that road is mostly safe. And then Bamiyan itself is totally safe. Once you get there, you can kind of exhale and just do whatever you would want to do, because that whole area is filled with Hazaras, which is an ethnic minority in Afghanistan. And this minority has had violent clashes with the Taliban in the past, and the two groups really hate each other. So there's absolutely no interest among the Hazaras in this region for the Taliban to be there.
I'm wondering if the region has attracted tourists in the past when things were safe, before the Taliban. Was this a booming tourist destination then?
Right. Before the Taliban, before the Civil War, before that, and before the Soviet invasion.
A long time ago.
You got to go all the way back to the 1960s and 1970s. During that period, Afghanistan actually was a little bit on the hippie travel circuit, and a lot of Westerners hung out in Kabul, and it was a very liberal place at the time, actually, and Bandi Amir was a premier destination for a lot of those folks, as well as for Afghans. So the local villagers sort of remember that time as this golden age when they had all these tourists and all this business, and it really helped sort of their level of prosperity, and they're hoping that this designation of a national park will inspire a little bit of that tourism to come back.
Is that why they made it a national park? Here in this country, we often designate something a national park to protect it from development. Why did they need to make it a national park? How does that protect it?
That's actually the question I had. That's why one of the reasons I picked this story when I was thinking about stories to do heading into Afghanistan. I mean, and in terms of protection, there are these 13 villages within the park, and there had been a bunch of sort of businesses, kebab stands, trinket shops, right up to the edge of some of these beautiful lakes. And there was a motorboat tour you could take, but the motorboat was really old and it was leaking oil into the water. And then locals were fishing with rocket launchers and grenades.
How do you fish with grenades and rocket launchers?
Well, you just pull the pin and toss the grenade in, and
you
boom.
Kill the fish?
And
you
then
just
you
blow
get,
up a bunch get, of fish?
Right. You blow up a bunch. It's easy. Forget about hook,
they
line,
all
and
float
sinker.
To the surface?
They float to the surface, and you grab them, and instantly you've got a whole basket of fish. But very quickly, you have a lake without
fish. The beauty
fish.
And the
right.
silence. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So they put an end to that. They moved back all of those shops from the edge of the lake to an area sort of removed off to the side. And then they also curtailed new cultivation of fields right up to the banks of the lakes, as well as grazing and a few other things. So far, the locals have mostly seen the national park for what restrictions it's brought them.
Do they resent that?
Well, there's buy-in that they want a national park because they believe that it will bring this tourist development. And they're fine trading some of those aspects of their livelihood for the promise of all of these foreigners coming with money, because they think they can. That's a better way of life. And they too also believe the place is beautiful and they don't want to see it ruined. So there's buy-in for the park idea. It's just they're frustrated that most of the effort so far has gone into the actual protection mission of the park. And very little or kind of haphazard effort was put towards tourist development. They did, one of the groups involved in this did train one representative of each village to be a tour guide. And that was a year ago. And locals were telling me, so they got this training, but they don't really know what to do now. They don't know where to meet tourists. There's no sort of helpful infrastructure for starting a business along those lines.
So the money and the tourism really isn't coming in.
Exactly. And that's not necessarily entirely the fault of the people trying to help develop this park. It's also the bad headlines over the past year about Afghanistan and its security. I mean, unfortunately, most of the attacks that you'll read about and hear about in the papers or on the radio, those are happening in southeastern Afghanistan, a totally different region. But all you hear is Afghanistan. And so they think the whole country is very, very unsafe. Whereas, you know, to actually visit Bamiyan, it's much, much safer proposition. But the tourist companies that are trying to get Westerners to come have found that the news out of the region in the past year has really killed their business.
Yeah, understandably so.
Yeah, they're hoping that the surge will bring a little bit of stability and that it will help.
Well, we're glad you took the trip and could describe it for us until it's safer for more people to go.
Thank you.
Ben Arnoldy is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. To read his story about Afghanistan's first national park and to see photos, visit our website at worldvisionreport.org. If a vacation in Afghanistan is too big a reach, you might consider heading farther east to Nepal, which may be best known for its spectacular Mount Everest. A little less known in Nepal, but every bit as loved by the locals, is a snack you can buy right on the road. It's called selroti. That's a fried bread that looks kind of like a donut. Reporter Laura Spiro got her hands into rice batter in the kitchen of some friends in Pokhara. When she was done cooking, she sent us this report for our What's Cooking series.
We're crowded onto the floor of Sarsoti Subedi's kitchen with her family. I'd introduce you to everyone, but you'll forget all their names. Over there, though, is Sarsoti's 13-year-old son, Basanta, who I nicknamed Roti when I first met him years ago while doing exactly this activity. We make selroti every time we're together, and that's how it's often made, with lots of friends around. Sarsoti's daughter-in-law, Sita, is mixing up a huge pot of batter right now. Rice flour, sugar, warm water, and then a modern addition.
Baking powder.
Some baking powder from a nearby shop. Sita's also added powder from the ground bark of a kaulo tree. While Sita's mixing the batter with her hands, let's scoot over here, where Sarsoti, the matriarch, is busy chopping up radishes for vegetable chutney that we'll eat with the bread. She's cutting up the radishes and some chilies with a small scythe. Do you use this scythe for other things or just for cutting peppers?
The scythe is used for other things too, like cutting grass.
What else?
Mula katni. Cutting radishes?
What else?
What am I supposed to say to that? The scythe is for everything. It cuts anything.
Now Sarsati is going to mash the chili on a large, flat rock, along with spices.
Khursani, masala, chili pepper, cumin and coriander, fresh ginger, and turmeric. Then you mush it together with your hands.
Let's go back and check out what Sita is up to. She's got a huge pot of batter, and she's getting ready to fry it in a bowl of oil that is spitting hot over the fire. This is the really exciting part. Now, the goal here is simply to pour some batter in the shape of a ring into the oil. The art, however, is in using your hand to scoop up a palmful of sloshy batter out of the pot, and then, without spilling, pour it out of your hand and into the oil to create a perfect ring.
More often than not, the amateur cook, such as myself, produces a collection of burnt little roti blobs. My young friend Basanta, or Roti as I call him, gets no end of amusement out of watching me try this. Sita's actually going to scoop the batter with a conical-shaped cup that has a hole in the bottom. It's really easy to get a perfectly formed cell roti with this thing. Sita says it has to cook for 2 minutes. And we'll flip it over by hooking it with this small stick, which is made from bamboo. It was cut with, yes, you guessed it, a scythe. Eventually, Sita fishes out the roti and places it on a plate, and then quickly drops in the next one. Before long, there are small mountains of cell roti heaped all over the kitchen.
Wait out! I'm gonna do it.
Cell roti is eaten at almost any celebration, and often when friends get together. It's cooked for weddings, religious ceremonies, or when a woman is returning to her husband's house after visiting her birth home. Perhaps most importantly, these fried rings are ubiquitous during the harvest festivals of Tihar and Dasai, when people go from house to house, receiving blessings from friends and family, and eating cell roti. In fact, I enjoyed my first Dasai festival in Nepal so much that I made myself sick on cell roti. Sarsoti is going to finish things up by cooking the radish chutney we prepped earlier. Those mashed spices get blackened in a bit of oil, and then she adds in the radish, some sour lime juice, and some tomato that's been cut with a scythe. The chutney's gonna simmer while rings of cell roti pile up here next to Sita. You'd never make just one cell roti at a time. They gradually overtake the kitchen and half the dishware by the time the batter's used up. We end up swiping from the plates as Sita adds to them, cooking and eating at the same time. For the World Vision Report, I'm Laura Spiro in Pokhara, Nepal.
Check out the donuts and the cooking session. There's a slideshow on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up...
Are you ready?
Homeless men take their stories to the stage.
We're going to show you how we roll. All the stories you're going to see here are true. I know. I've lived most of them.
The Seldom Seen Acting Company, soon to be heard on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. Tough economic times have driven up the ranks of the homeless in the U.S. The latest numbers from the Department of Housing and Urban Development show that the number of homeless families rose 9% last year. It's one thing to know the statistics. It's another to know the stories behind them. And that's exactly what an unusual acting company is bringing to the stage. Lisa Morehouse reports from Hayward, California.
About 200 sophomores at Moreau Catholic High School in Hayward funnel into the gym and take a seat on the floor underneath a bank of fluorescent lights. They're here to watch a performance by a very unusual cast of actors.
We have brought you the Seldom Seen Acting Company.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
We're going to show you how we roll. All the stories you're going to see here are true. I know. I've lived most of them.
Alfonso Williams and the other cast members of Seldom Seen have all been homeless. Actors create storylines out of events in their real lives and perform these plays at local schools, churches, and theaters. One of today's vignettes depicts how homeless people get caught in the bureaucracy of the healthcare system.
Number 18, please.
Did they call 200 yet?
No, man. Sorry, man. What are you waiting for?
I need you to fill this paperwork out for me, sir, so I can get you in to see a doctor, sir.
Well, look, man, I can't fill out anything because my hand is cut.
In another scene, a character named JR is betrayed by a colleague at the Oakland airport.
Hey, JR, the boss want to talk to you.
Hey, John, good morning. How you doing?
JR, we got to let you go. You're fired.
Oh, no. Can't be happening. My rent. Oh.
For actor JR, or Jose Rodriguez, this experience 5 years ago left him homeless.
Inside, I die. I was dead. I find myself
feeding the pigeons and the geese, drinking beer at the lake for 3 months straight.
Rodriguez eventually found social services at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Oakland, which runs the Seldom Seen Company. He started volunteering there and joined the acting company. It took him a while, but Rodriguez found his voice through acting.
At first, I was real quiet. I didn't want to talk. Then about two or three months later, I was talking so loud that everybody was telling me, be quiet. Yes.
I'm going to leave you with this little song. It goes like this. Last train, all aboard now.
Hi, I'm Nico Marcello, and I am a sophomore at Monroe Catholic High School. And what I just watched, it was pretty emotional and stuff like that. It gave me a reality check on what I have and what could happen to me if I don't listen to the right people and stuff like that.
Cast member Alan Nichols says that to develop scenes, the actors and directors start talking about a theme like substance abuse or health care.
It's kind of like somebody comes up with an idea, somebody adds to that idea, somebody else adds to that idea. We build it, and we got to play.
Nichols sports a baby face and red button-up shirt. He heard about Seldom Seen when a buddy at St. Vincent de Paul said there was an easy way to make a little money. Actors in the Seldom Seen company earn $50 for each performance.
First it was a hustle and it was just about the money, but then after a while it just got to be like, you know, this is really you know, fun, and this is, I mean, just, it's just really positive, and I just started really getting into it. I mean, it's just kind of like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon, you know, so.
When they come in to rehearsals and they've got a story to tell, they have more passion for it.
Andrew J. Nice is Seldom Seen's director. He directs professional actors in advertisements, music videos, and fight choreography. But none of these other jobs packs the punch of working with Seldom Seen.
I can take Denzel Washington and just sit there and drill him with, you know, be a homeless person, go out, live, talk to homeless people, be a homeless person for a day, you know, beg for change for a day, and I won't get the intensity that these guys get.
Nice says that acting can be therapeutic for the members. And that's certainly the case for Michael Pritchard, a soft-spoken guy with hair past his shoulders. He credits Seldom Seen with his new focus on self-improvement and for helping him stay off drugs.
Every day is a struggle, and we try to support each other. You know, it's like a family, you know, and that's one thing I really enjoy, is if I have a problem and I need somebody to talk to, I could turn to one of my fellow actors and have a conversation.
Most of the 14 members of Seldom Seen are now in stable housing. And St. Vincent de Paul is aiming for a similar atmosphere of support with the chorus they're hoping to start. For the World Vision Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Hayward, California.
Last train, all aboard now. Leaving, overbooked now.
The doctor told him that he's well and that he can leave now. He says his health's come back and he thinks that he is all right now. He wants to thank the folks who really stuck by him. He was as gone as he could be. He wants to thank his stars and be happy, because Overbrook is sending him home. All together now.
Last train, all aboard now.
The Seldom Seen Acting Company has an ally in a 14-year-old schoolboy named David Ashby. David spent a good part of his summer on the road. Instead of hanging out at the mall or at the pool, he was walking, yes, walking from his home in Florida to Washington, D.C., all in an effort to draw attention to the problem of homelessness. We caught up with David on the last leg of his journey.
How did you become interested in the issue of homelessness?
When I saw the rising numbers in the United States and my local area, I thought I'd do something about it. But I think the last estimate was 70 children in my school alone were homeless, and then my best friend became homeless shortly after I came up with this idea. And that's when I thought, okay, it can't happen to anybody. I need to do something.
Going to school with kids who are homeless and having your best friend become homeless, what was it you were thinking? You were, what, 13 or 14? How did it affect you?
Well, because I was thinking that, you know, when you hear that there's 7 kids at my school alone, that's just like a, you're like, wow, because, you know, you don't really see these kids because they're really good at hiding, and then my best friend became homeless, and we never thought that ever happened.
So how did you come up with this idea? Why walk? Why not just do a campaign from your hometown?
Because throughout history, walking has done like had the biggest impact for change. And I was thinking, you know, I need to do something, but then I came up with this idea about walking to D.C. because that seemed like the best idea to do it.
And how many miles have you walked so far?
I think we've come up to about 1,000.
Mm. What did your folks think of this idea?
I did a lot of research before I came and told them because of the fact, you know, I want to come up with a game plan and everything before I actually came and told them. And then when I finally did, it was more of a, you know, I need your support instead of I need your permission.
And what'd they say?
They jumped on board and they told everybody they knew.
You're kind of young to be walking across the country. Are there any adults traveling with you?
Yes, my mother and my mother's best friend, who's my godmother.
They're walking too?
No, my mother's driving and my godmother's walking with me.
Where do you stay at night?
In the van.
What's it been like so far, David?
It's been quite an adventure, but you meet a lot of, you know, interesting people and hear their stories, and it's a life-changing thing.
How are you raising attention to the issue of homelessness along the way?
Well, we're stopping at different shelters along the way and hearing these kids' stories, because a lot of these kids, you know, they're even though, you know, they've had a rough time, they all have their own, you know, I want to grow up and do this or that. So then I turn around and tell everybody about that, give them the facts and everything about homelessness and their areas and stuff. And it's just in this country alone, there's 1.5 million homeless children, that's estimated, as of like February this year. So that's what we tell people.
So you say you've been visiting local shelters where you've actually met some of the homeless children.
Yes.
Anyone who struck you in particular, whose story you want to tell us about?
Yes, there was a kid in, who was like 15 in Jacksonville. And, you know, he lives a normal life, and then his mom lost a job because of the economic time, and they lost their home and became homeless. And that he never thought that ever happened to him, and he's just so full of life still, you know. You know, it's just an average kid.
Has it been scary for you? I mean, you meet a kid your age who's homeless. Have you thought, wow, that could be me?
I have, and that's why, you know, I think that you should do as much as you can.
Now, you don't have too much longer to reach your destination of Washington, D.C. What then?
Rallying for 3 days, visiting the area and the local shelters in D.C. We'll be doing that for 3 days, and then I have to get back to Orlando to go to school.
Anybody special you want to meet at the nation's capital?
Yes, the president, hopefully.
You think you'll get to meet him?
I hope so.
If you get to meet the president, what will you tell him?
You know, just want to share the stories of the children with him and hopefully get him to, you know, work on this problem.
David, do you think you're going to be able to accomplish your goals for this trip?
Oh, yes. The raising awareness was the main goal of the entire thing, so we're almost there.
What do you think, as a 14-year-old doing this project, what do you think is the answer to solving this crisis of youth homelessness?
Many people have a lot of time on their hands that they don't do anything with. And I believe if everybody went and just, you know, volunteered at their local shelter, you know, gave their time to, you know, helping these people, the problem wouldn't be as bad as it is now.
Okay, David, we wish you the very best on your way to D.C., and I hope you get to meet the president. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Ashby completed his 1,100-mile trek from Florida to Washington, D.C. just a week ago. He didn't get to see the president, but he did get a chance to speak with several congressmen and women about homelessness in America. You can find a link to David's blog on our website, worldvisionreport.org. A new president has just been elected in the tiny oil-rich country of Gabon in Central Africa. The country's former president, Omar Bongo, died in June after 41 years of autocratic rule. Many in Gabon hoped this election would turn around decades of corruption. The former president and his family lived in extreme wealth and luxury, while the vast majority of the population lived in abject poverty. But election results placed the late ruler's son, Ali Ben Bongo, in first place. So many believe the gap between rich and poor isn't likely to shrink. If you stroll through the capital, Libreville, you'll see a mix of ostentatious palaces and dusty, dilapidated streets. Megan Williams was there recently, and she sent us this reporter's notebook about her last evening in the city. She had dinner with two French military couples, whom she'd only just met.
We head for a restaurant district renowned for its barbecued fish. We sit down at a table, place our orders, and soon a woman returns with our food. Platters piled high with rice, cassava, fried banana plantain, and little bowls of spicy sauce. We dig in. When we're almost through eating, a young man appears at the end of our table. He has a small, sharp nose, tiny beads of sweat dotting his forehead, and wide-spaced, feverish eyes. Without a hint of aggression, but no apology either, he pulls up a chair and asks if he can eat our fish heads. We all look at each other. Nellie, one of the French wives, makes a little shooing motion with her arm. I look down at the fish spine that curves across my plate. It's stripped bare of its flesh, but the head is still intact. Our waitress appears and hisses something under her breath. Marie-Claire tells him yes, he can have our fish heads, but he must eat them away from us, at another empty table. He stays. Nellie tries another tactic. You can sit here, but you can't speak to us. The military men, grim and embarrassed, are silent. The young man pulls my plate in front of him, and his fingers begin to dart over the skeleton of the fish, picking off little pieces I'd missed and flicking them into his mouth. I slide the platters of plantain and cassava closer to him. How old are you? I ask. 19, he says, stuffing hunks of cassava into his mouth. Something softens in Marie-Claire's expression, and she asks him where his parents are. Dead, he says between swallows, and now he lives on the street. He has two younger brothers. They stay with an organization that shelters street kids. Marie-Claire recognizes the name. It was founded by a retired French military officer, she tells me. She and Nellie and other military wives knit things and sell them to raise money for the shelter. You see, cries Nellie from the far end of the table, we give money to help you. I ask the young man how much schooling he's had. He eyes me with those wild eyes and says, I cannot tell a lie. I finished young, at 15. Not so young, I say. I would have wanted to keep studying, he answers. What would you like to do with your life? Work. What type of work? Anything, even hard work. Anything not to live on the street. He leans in close to me and says, I think about suicide all the time, every day. Then he sits back and slowly nods. I cannot tell a lie, he repeats. Everyone can lie, I say. I don't know why I say this, except that maybe sitting next to a young homeless person who's eating the fish head on your plate and who tells you a life story that's full of loss, part of you wants to think it could be a lie, that this raw, desperate, wild need can't be real. It's time to leave. I ask the young man his name. Idriss, he says, licking his fingers. I hand him a napkin, but he's not yet finished eating. As I'm about to stand up, Idriss leans in again and whispers, you'll give me 200 francs for my breakfast tomorrow, about 80 cents. He says it the same way he sat down. No aggression, no apology, just a straightforward statement of need. I give him more, about $2, because it's the smallest bill I have, and I wish him luck. We climb back into the four-wheel drive. As my French host flicks on the blinker to enter the stream of cars on the road, I catch one last glimpse of Idriss. He's moved on from my plate and is now eating the fish head on Marie-Claire's. Our waitress has appeared beside him again, her face twisted in rage. She holds a long wooden stick in her hand and begins whacking him on the back with it, screaming something I can't hear through the noise of the traffic. The car pulls away. The French army officer, my host, quietly says, Vous voyez une page de l'Afrique. A page out of Africa. A page out of the world, I think.
Megan Williams is a freelance reporter based in Rome. Thank you. That's it for this week. We're going to leave you today with more hip-hop from Burma. Don't forget to visit our website to hear and see more about the show. And you can read blogs from our reporters from far-flung parts of the world. The address, one more time, worldvisionreport.org. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepard are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
ကိုစပြပြီးဟောက်ဘာညာဘာညာစကားမြမင်းစီကိုဖုန်းဆက်ဖို့ဆိုတကယ်တကယ်ကြောက်အမြဆက်ဆက်ဆက်မညာနဲ့ကကကကကပါလာချင်းချင်းတက်မပြီးတော့ငါစီမမလာပါဟောလာလိုက်ပြောလို့လည်းနဲ့အင်ကကိလုံလုံးနေဟာဘေးနားမှာရှိနေရင်လည်းရစ်တဲ့နေမပြောင်းနေဟာရှားအားလုံးတိတ်စိတ်မင်းမရှိတဲ့ငါအိမ်ထဲမှာကိုနေရှူတွေနားကောင်တွေမင်းကပါလက်မှတ်တာလားကလာတရားချင်းချင်းတက်မင်းကငါကိုဖြတ်မှာလားဒီစားနဲ့စားနေကြတဲ့င legendary